Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking with Kevin Prantis, he's staff with the Prison Moratorium Project, which is working on criminal justice issues in the United States and our crisis of over-incarceration. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
Now, why don't you give us a little context of the problem of over-incarceration in the United States. We hear the figure that we have more people per capita in prison in the United States than South Africa did under apartheid or China does. And give us a little bit of the context of that.
Sure. There are a lot of people actually are familiar with the figure. Now, there are more than 2 million men and women in prison and jail in the United States today. And to give people a sense of what that really means, because the number itself, you know, a lot of people say, well, is that a big number, a small number? There are 8 million prisoners in the entire world. That means that a quarter of all prisoners are locked up in the U.S., even though we have only 5% of the world's population, which means that our rate of incarceration is five times the world average and higher than any other industrialized nation in the world. It's also expanded rapidly over the last 40 years. In 1970, there were 300,000 men and women in prison and jail. And so from 300,000 to 2 million is about a 6.5-fold increase. And I think the irony is that if you ask people sort of on the street if they feel that they're 6.5 times safer after this massive prison expansion, they'll laugh at you.
Mm-hmm. And the prison justice system, the criminal justice system, is disproportionately jailing African Americans and Hispanics.
Yeah, it's over 50% of prison and jail inmates are African American alone. If you look at African American and Hispanic, a lot of times it gets up to 70%, and especially in the Northeast. And there's actually some research being done, a study that's going to be released shortly, that shows that almost all of the increase that's happened, you know, over the last 15 to 20 years has been locking up more people of color. That is, tough on crime really means tough on people of color.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a system that's racist, that's filling up our supposed surplus minorities in the prisons. We have a poor education system. How does that contribute to the...
Absolutely. The problem is that, you know, again, over the last 30 years, as people know, tax increases haven't been very popular. It means that state governments are looking at a relatively limited amount of money, and each time you spend another dollar locking someone up, and it is very expensive to lock people up at the tune of $20,000 to $30,000 a year just for operations costs, that money has to come from somewhere. The evidence shows that most of it is coming from public higher education, and it's sort of ironic because it's really taking opportunities away from, you know, the very people who sort of need the most, right? So instead of encouraging people to, you know, get better educated for the new information economy, they're taking money away from education in nearly a dollar-for-dollar fashion and putting it into prison expansion. We've seen that happen in New York for a number of years. Between 88 and 98, there was a $615 million cut in higher education spending and a $760 million increase in correction spending, according to the Justice Policy Institute. And that means that state universities and city university students are being directly affected by prison expansion. And our campaign has been geared toward helping make them aware of that, sort of under the banner of education, not incarceration.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we've got the drug war, the American distinctively criminal approach, although it has to be multifactorial because there are countries that have more draconian drug laws than we do and don't have as many people in prison. But compared to at least to our European allies, we have a far more criminal justice approach to drugs.
Yes. Well, part of it's the laws that are on the books. But the other thing I think is enforcement, that it wasn't just a toughening of the laws. It was also, you know, tremendous spending on enforcement of drug laws, and partly there's sort of perverse incentives to and perverse structure in the way the drug laws are set up that encourages getting as many people in as possible, generally low-level people. A couple things. One is that increasingly, this is very aggressive policing, particularly in poor neighborhoods where people are just randomly stopped and searched constantly. There's lots of sting operations. People are sort of set up. There's increasing use of informants who get nailed with some drugs, and then in order to get a reduction in this sort of huge mandatory minimum sentence, they are responsible for trying to turn in or help convict as many people as possible. We believe that this is leading to the conviction of many innocent people, as well as many people who were involved in some level, but clearly are not responsible for the drug problem.
Now, you've been engaged in a number of campaigns through the Prison Moratorium Project. You mentioned education, not incarceration. Tell us about the No Punishment for Profit campaign.
Yeah, No Punishment for Profit, which actually we're now sort of focused on sort of calling Not With Our Money. And that's a national and increasingly international campaign against corporations that profiteer off punishment. Specifically, we're looking at the for-profit private prison industry, which has grown very rapidly since the mid-80s when it started, and the corporations that either invest in or help underwrite prison privatization. Specifically, we are looking at the connection between Sodexo Marriott Services, the nation's largest food service provider, particularly on college campuses, and their parent company, the Paris-based Sodexo Alliance, and the private prison industry. Sodexo Alliance is not only the largest institutional investor in Corrections Corporation of America with an 8% stake and a board member on the CCA board, since the fall, they have also begun being involved in the direct ownership and operation of for-profit private prisons in the United Kingdom and Australia. And we have students on more than 50 campuses who are actively working to get Sodexo kicked off campus, to lose their dining service contracts, unless the parent company, Sodexo Alliance, divests itself of private prisons.
Now, that campaign's had some remarkable successes in terms of getting colleges to address this issue. Can you talk about some of the places where they've made advances?
Sure. There are four campuses where our activists have helped to get Sodexo kept or kicked off campus. State University of New York at Albany, Sodexo was under attack by students both for the prison connection and even more importantly for their refusal to recognize a campus union, and due to both problems with the company and student activism, which led on April 4th of last year to a number of arrests. They lost the contract at SUNY Albany. They also lost an opportunity to come on to Evergreen State in college in Washington, where the administration had announced they were going with Sodexo and were forced to back down after student protests. At Goucher College, students convinced their administration to change food service providers. And at James Madison University, students who are actually part of a young Democratic Socialist group, protested, and that summer the college decided not to renew its contract with Sodexo. In the first three cases, we think the private prison issue played a major role in having them lose their contracts. In the last case, I think it played a role, but we wouldn't claim that as necessarily just a victory of the campaign.
Now, why are not only Americans, but also apparently Brits and Australian governments, Australia, unfortunately, under a Labor government, and right, Britain as well. Why are they turning to private prisons? Is the logic behind a private prison the logic behind all privatization, that it's going to be more efficient? Are there union reasons for getting rid of state-owned prisons? What's going on?
There are a couple. The sort of alleged reason for going with private prisons is that they're supposed to be perhaps more innovative, but really just cheaper. They're looking for cheap solutions to the prison problem. All the literature is inconclusive at best when it comes to the savings that private prisons are supposed to create. So there's really no evidence that anyone's really saving any money using private prisons. All that private prisons really do is turn fairly decently paid public sector corrections jobs into very poorly paid private sector corrections job, and then they take the surplus and then they understaff the prisons, cut programs, and take all the surplus and give it to their executives and stockholders. The state ends up paying about as much money and gets a lot more problems for the bargain. So the real reason I think that prisons get privatized, since they don't really save money and since they're run very poorly, even compared to public prisons, is twofold. One, ideological, or threefold, really. First is there are people who are ideologically committed to privatization, and so even though private prisons are a total disaster, they continue to push them. The second reason is because the private prison industry has lots of money to throw around at legislators through lobbying, through campaign contributions, and through a revolving door where people leave politics and corrections and get jobs in private prison companies, much as they did and do in the military-industrial complex. The third reason, which I think is probably the most important, is that, private prisons provide private capital to help expand prisons faster. The reality is that even though the public is afraid of crime, most people are not willing to see their taxes raised significantly to build another prison. And the difficulty lawmakers have run into is that they keep wanting to keep pushing tough on crime sentences, but they can't get the public to approve bond measures that would allow them to borrow money and build prisons. And this is true in the UK and Australia, all over the place. They're having difficulty getting the public to borrow money, and so they have this backdoor method of borrowing money where they go to a private prison company, and the private prison company goes to a bank and borrows money and builds the prison itself, and then the public sector just rents it out. Now, in the short term, it means the public doesn't have to come up with the capital to build a prison. In the long term, obviously, it's more expensive for the same reason that it's more expensive to rent an apartment than to buy a house, right? Because the private prison companies are going to get their money back.
And they're going to make profits.
And they're going to make profits. And it's also more expensive for a private company to borrow money than for the state to borrow money. So in every way, it's less efficient, more expensive. But again, it's a lot easier to put the prison on your credit card with a private prison company than to go to the public and explain and get public approval for the bonds needed to build up another public prison.
Now, I'm speaking with Kevin Prentice. He's the staff person for the Prison Moratorium Project. And you can find the Prison Moratorium Project at nomoreprisons.org. Now, let's just keep with the private prisons for a second. We actually have a professor here in our sociology department who's an advocate of private prisons. So I'm sure there are some students here.
Charles Logan, is it?
Charles Logan.
Oh, that's right. Charles Logan.
At University of Connecticut.
Right.
So I'm sure there are some students listening to us today who are going to be curious about what we have to say. So the private prisons, their argument is that they can come up with some kind of, obviously they think that it's not going to be more expensive in the long run. They're trying to sell themselves as not being more expensive.
Sure.
They think that they're going to be able to economize in what? They're going to use fewer towels. They're going to work prisoners harder at making license plates. I mean, what exactly is their argument for the economics of privatization?
Their argument tends to be vague. Susan Hart is this spokesperson for Corrections Corporation of America. She's a great example. I've talked to reporters who have tried to get out of her exactly where it is that private prison companies save money, and they keep coming back to this phrase, red tape. They cut down on the red tape. It would lead you to believe that public prison companies were literally spending millions of dollars on stalking, actual red tape, right? The reality is that they can't. I mean, the truth is, that the answers are not very pretty. I actually know somebody who is a prisoner in Tennessee prisons, and he sort of explains how they save money. He says, and state and CCA prisons, he says, his name's Alex Friedman, and he's done great research and is now outside. And he says, in a state prison, they give you two blankets. In a CCA prison, they give you one. In the state prison, they give you, a meal. It's not very good, but it's a meal. And in CCA prisons, the joke is that the food's bad and there's not enough of it. But, in addition to that, they make cutbacks. For example, Alex explains that in a CCA prison, when they had to have somebody set up a computer program to run the cameras on the perimeter security fence of the prison, they had a prisoner set up that computer program. And when they wanted someone to do a drawing of all the fire exits in the building, you know, using the blueprints for the prison, they had a prisoner working on those blueprints.
That doesn't sound very smart.
No, it doesn't sound very smart. And he says, you know how I know they had a prisoner doing this? Because I was that prisoner. So they have this guy, Alex Friedman, you know, prisoner, convicted of bank robbery, going and working over the diagrams of the prison and doing the fire exits because, you know, fundamentally, they'll do anything to save a buck. Unfortunately,
they haven't watched enough prison movies.
They haven't watched enough prison movies, exactly. Well, that's why you have so many, you know, so many escapes, so many, you know, instances of violence. The unfortunate thing is those are sort of the funny examples. The less funny examples are cutbacks in programs. You see an example in Tennessee, a guy named Anthony Bowman died of pneumonia because CCA had an incentive contract with the doctor where his salary would double if he could provide significant cost cuts in the amount they were spending on medical costs. And so the way he achieved those cuts was to give Anthony a painkiller to treat his pneumonia. And he ended up going to a state hospital, very sick, died there. And his crime, not murder or rape, but bounced checks. So the state of Tennessee, I think irresponsibly, sentences him to prison for bounced checks, and CCA gives him a death sentence because they don't want to pay for his medical care. But even there, they can't save enough money to make a profit, and that's where staffing comes in. The bulk of, even though the facilities are somewhat expensive, the vast majority of the dollars spent on prisons are spent on prison staff, and that's where you can make the cuts. They don't really save money by paying their guards so little because they pay their executives so much, and the only real way to achieve savings is to understaff the prisons. And so jobs in private prisons are horrible. People are understaffed. They're sent in with very little training, you know, with way too many prisoners for the number of guards. And that's why you get so much violence. That's why you have extremely high staff turnover ratios. It's why the private prison companies can never bring the level of staffing up to the level required in the contracts that they've signed.
Which is already a problem in the public prisons, as we've seen in Texas and other places.
Exactly. No, what you see is the problems in the public prisons, in the private prisons, but magnified.
Yeah. Now, you're also engaged in a Teach Justice campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Teach Justice has really been about working with, you know, we do a lot of work with college students, but also, you know, part of the work is with young people like high school age youth, particularly in the city. And Teach Justice has been working to develop curriculum. We work with a great alternative high school here in New York, the East Side Community High School. It was a program one of our interns ran with high school students. They did an excellent expo at the end, educating their classmates about prison issues. And we're really trying to, you know, make a movement that's broader than just college students, that incorporates, you know, everyone, you know, 15 to 30 years old, sort of, you know, high school, you know, middle school, college students from both urban and rural areas coming together around a common agenda of stopping prison expansion. Done a couple of these day-long trainings for prison activists that sort of do everything from political education and information sessions on criminal justice issues to organizing and strategy development training to sort of training for how to do peer education with people around the issues. So we work with sort of a range, again, sort of 15 to 30, everyone from, you know, college and graduate students and recent college graduates to high school age students and youth.
You've also done something very innovative, which is cut an album. Can you tell us how that project came about?
The No More Prisons CD project started in, I think it was 97. It was the 25th anniversary of the Attica prison rebellion. Attica was a pretty horrible public prison in upstate New York where it was a rebellion, and the prisoners took over the prison, and then police were sent in, basically executed a large number of prisoners and put them through a gauntlet. It was a horrible sort of outbreak that led to a prison reform movement in the 70s, and we wanted to commemorate that with a public event in Brooklyn. There were some hip-hop artists involved in that, and that led to the idea of putting together what was then to be a very small CD of just the artists who came. Over a couple of years, it grew to be a much larger project that ended up involving more than 70 artists who collaborated to put together 23 tracks, all of them, most of them original, all of them focused on prison issues, and that was the No More Prisons CD, which came out last spring, about a year ago, and there's actually another CD in the works that'll come out sometime, you know, this spring, summer, fall. We're still piecing it together, but it's been a really powerful movement, you know, that's got a lot. It's reached out to, I think, both urban young people and college students who listen to hip hop.
Mm. I'm speaking with Kevin Prantis. He's the staff person for the Prison Moratorium Project, and you can find information about that and about the CD that you just mentioned at nomoreprisons.org. I have some final questions here about drug law reform. I've been an advocate of drug law reform for a long time, and I think that it's fair to say that the majority of people who are in the criminal justice system are there because drugs are illegal in the United States, as we mentioned at the top. And so isn't it, don't we need to address drug law reform as well as the prison justice issue? I mean, I see the logic of politically addressing prison issues because there's a fiscally conservative community out there who are going to be amenable to the arguments about the fiscal effects of continually building these prisons, and who might not be amenable to the drug legalization. But if we don't stop putting people in jail for drugs, we aren't going to be able to stop building prisons.
Yeah, you have to do both, and that's what, for instance, education, not incarceration in New York, our purpose is to focus on what's going on with prisons, but then to direct people into concrete things they can do to change that. In New York, the primary focus of our efforts is linking, you know, students and other people concerned about this whole education prison spending trade-off to an ongoing effort to reform the Rockefeller drug laws. They were some of the harshest and earliest drug laws in the country of their kind, implemented by Nelson Rockefeller, partly as a way to try and get elected try to get chosen in the Republican presidential nominations. They've been a terrible failure in the state, and for years politicians have flirted with reforming them. Unfortunately, because of the way prisons have been used for economic development in rural New York, there hasn't been much incentive to actually get down to reforming them, and that's partly due to a lack of grassroots muscle on our side, and that's what we're trying to help bring to this larger coalition, is a student youth movement that is really going to get out there and push hard for getting rid of the Rockefeller drug laws and then taking the money and putting it back into education and social programs.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're both students of Michael Harrington's brand of gradual utopianism, or a visionary gradualism. And given that we're under now a awful Republican presidency and an awful Republican control of Congress, what's the optimistic strategic viewpoint that you can present to me about the way forward? Do you think that, you know, the elections in 2002, the ongoing contradictions of the fiscal strain of having all these prisons is going to make this movement grow? Do you see signs that we're going to achieve tangible victories in the near term?
I think the signs are really good in terms of there's two things. One is, I think the momentum shifting in our way, let's say that the momentum is shifting somewhat in our favor, although the country's still going in the wrong direction. We're still locking up more people, passing more punitive laws, building more private prisons, but definitely the momentum has shifted. Finally, you know, prison expansion has become an issue in the last 5 years, the last 3 years, a lot of expanded media coverage. In the last year, a huge increase in the amount of dialogue and discussion and activism around this issue, so that's a good sign. I also think that the Bush sort of Ashcroft years will be interesting for us, because perhaps it will encourage liberals to rethink the relative silence that we've seen on criminal justice issues during the Clinton years. And there's a report that is just coming out from Justice Policy Institute that shows that far more African Americans were locked up under Clinton than under, you know, more than under Bush and Reagan combined. You know, unfortunately, Clinton's legacy on this issue was terrible, and I think it's a sort of sign of the times, but it's also a crucial question for Democrats. There are two ways Democrats can go at this point now that, you know, Democrats are sort of out of power. One is that they could go the way California's Democrats have gone, like Gray Davis, which is to basically fully endorse the growing prison industrial complex in order to completely inoculate themselves from sort of soft on crime armed charges. That's what they've done in California. Davis is completely in the pocket of pro-prison forces there. And even in a totally democratically controlled state, you're seeing prison expansion that even the Department of Corrections a few months ago was saying was unnecessary. On the other hand, you have the opportunity for Democrats to say, you know, to sort of look at Bush and look at what the Republicans are doing and start fighting it and start making prison expansion an issue. And I think that that's going to happen more and more as people realize what the consequences are of prison expansion. I'll just give you one example. There was some press given to the fact that when the 2000 census was conducted, prisoners were counted, as they're always counted, as residents of the jurisdictions where they're imprisoned, although in almost all states they cannot vote in those jurisdictions. What that means is that you're seeing a net transfer of voting power and actually also other federal dollars like highway funds, Head Start funds, from poor inner city, you know, heavily Democratic communities to poor rural, heavily Republican communities. In New York, there's probably 50,000 people, you know, who come from sort of urban, you know, core Democratic areas who've been shipped out to Republican areas, and that is about a third of an assembly seat. So this is, you know, as we do redistricting, or as we look at Florida, where the number of people disqualified from voting as a result of felony convictions was much larger than the margin by which George Bush allegedly won that election. That should tell Democrats something about the way criminal justice issues play and the way that they affect political dynamics. I think it would be suicide for Democrats to continue to just lay down in front of policies that are clearly failing and that are going after the base of, you know, sort of progressive political base in this country. And so I think that in a way, Bush and Ashcroft are an opportunity for that. That said, we're definitely going to see, I think, an even more concerted push for, you know, more tough on crime, longer sentences, you know, more going after, well, we've seen a lot of going after kids, trying to put them in adult jail, sentence them to adult time. We'll probably see more private prisons. There's, you know, Texas is way, way ahead of the entire rest of the country in terms of the number of people in for-profit private prisons. So I think those are all things that we can look forward to in terms of initiatives from Bush and Ashcroft. The big question is, are progressives and are Democrats going to stand up on those issues, make them an issue, and win in the public, or are they going to say, well, we can't win on this, so we're just going to let them do it?
Kevin, I'm really glad you're doing this work, and I want everyone to go out and check out nomoreprisons.org, the Prison Moratorium Project. There are pages there about how you can organize prison moratorium work in your own community, in your own school. Especially students and youth have a lot of tasks that they can devote themselves to around this goal. And can they contact you, Kevin?
Yeah, they can contact us at 646-486-6715 or by email at kpranis, K-P-R-A-N-I-S, at nomoreprisons.org. I should also mention that, I forgot to mention, we were talking about the No More Prisons CD. That CD was actually put out by this new progressive record label, Raptivism Records, which just amazing group of activists who decided that hip-hop needs a really political label, and people can go out and support Raptivism and us, get the No More Prisons CD, keep track of what's coming out from them and from us. That'd be great. And I should mention also that in terms of the Sodexo campaign, there's a number of Sodexo contracts in Connecticut, University of Bridgeport, Western Connecticut State, Fairfield University, Mitchell College, and Eastern Connecticut State University all use Sodexo. Those are all places where student dollars are essentially benefiting prison profiteers.
Well, I hope they're in touch with you about that. Thanks a lot for coming on, Kevin.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.